Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Elevated Places with Dr. Ava Muhammad. Dr. Ava is a gifted attorney, researcher, lecturer, and author of 5 books. She received her Juris Doctorate from Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., and is a member of the New York Bar Association. Dr. Ava has been featured in Essence magazine many times and was named by Essence as one of America's most powerful black women. Join Dr. Ava every Thursday evening here on Blog Talk Radio, where you will hear a message that will provide you with the tools needed to repair and uplift the spirit, moral character, and living condition of the black woman. Our call-in number is 347-324-5091. Or visit us on our radio show page at blogtalkradio.com/elevatedplaces. And now, here is your host, Dr. Ava Muhammad.
Welcome to Elevated Places. I am your host, Dr. Ava Muhammad. And to the Elevated Places family, we are so honored and blessed to be with you once again and give you the greetings of peace of Assalamu Alaikum. And to our first-time listeners, peace be unto you as well, Assalamu Alaikum. And you are going to spend the next 90 minutes in the company of the most astute interactive audience in the world of internet radio. We are live on blogtalkradio.com/elevatedplaces. That's blogtalkradio.com/elevatedplaces. This is a talk show. And so, of course, we are driven by the discussion, and that discussion is made rich and full by interaction with the callers. And so we want you not only to log in, but also to call in at 347-324-5091. That's 347-324-5091. And, of course, when you call in, you can indicate it's menu-driven and user-friendly, and it will ask you to indicate if you want to talk to the host. And if you do that, you'll be placed in queue to join the conversation. Now, of course, we are continuing our quest for independence and freedom to act in our own self-interest. And the past 2 weeks with our home builder, Brother Alexander Muhammad, who is just not only a professional, but a brother with a very profound knowledge of the need for and the means by which we can establish residential communities from the ground up. Brother Alexander out of Houston, Texas, it was awesome to have him on for the past 2 weeks. And the powerful thing is that in the course of his presence, we discovered other tradesmen and women and builders in our midst, and it's just been phenomenal. And so he and Dr. Ridgely Muhammad, our Elevated Places contributor, are working together to gather information so that we can pool our resources and make the dream of our own residential communities a reality. And of course, I'll say this now, and I hope to remember at the end as well, that this show would not be possible without the Elevated Places team, our show producer, Rona Muhammad, our researcher, Bobby Muhammad, and our technical expert, Sister LaDonna Muhammad. And, of course, joining me, as always, is my beloved co-host, who is so popular as a key member of this show, and he's just so insightful, and he's a traveler, he's a world traveler, and always brings us the latest news of the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan's whereabouts and activities, and we also discuss what's going on here in the country, and he is with me now. I'm always pleased to be able to greet him. Assalamu alaikum, my co-host, Brother Terrence Muhammad.
Wa alaikum salam, ma'am.
It's great to have you on. And I'm going to bring you into this conversation. Also, Dr. Ridgely Muhammad, our Elevated Places contributor, is on the line, so we can get his mic open as well. But we're approaching a presidential election where Republicans are making an overt and really blatant attempt to disenfranchise us, using these draconian laws that all of a sudden you need a state-issued photo ID. The nominee that they have chosen for the presidential election is showing us that he's contemptuous of a society that even looks like it might take care of its citizens. And later on tonight, really thanks to you, Brother Terrence, we're blessed to have joining us later this evening will be the author, Michelle Alexander, and we'll talk about her prior to her coming on. But this is one of our most brilliant legal scholars and activists as we go through the early phase of the 21st century. She is a powerful black woman who has actually set off a firestorm across America. And she's the author of the book, The New Jim Crow. If you have not read this book, you really have not completed your life cycle. But I want to go back before we address The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. Let's talk about the news. You can go right ahead, Brother Terrence, and we can start out with the central figure at this moment of exodus, and that's Minister Louis Farrakhan.
Yes, it's an honor and a privilege and a blessing to be on this talk show. And, you know, we always thank the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan for the work that he's doing. And, you know, one of the things that we're going to talk tonight about is, you know, the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, you know, is a man that we have seen has had the men of the Nation of Islam going out into the communities and reaching our people and touching them where they are, not, you know, necessarily driving them into the mosque, but going right into their communities, right to their doorsteps, right where they're hanging out and meeting them. So some people will criticize and say, well, y'all only deal with y'all people, only black people. But no, the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan is not just a state person. He's a worldwide leader, and countries are seeking him. And so he's now in Cuba, and he's meeting with the family of the Cuban Five, and so he's there with them in Cuba. So he's touching people across the globe and across the world. So Minister Farrakhan is traveling, and he's also, you know, he's modern, and he's on Twitter now. You know, you can go see Minister Farrakhan at Louis Farrakhan. You can tweet him now, and he's having a town hall meeting September the 26th, this coming Wednesday. And you can go to askfarrakhan.com and ask your question. There's a website that you can go ask questions. You can go to noi.org and prepare to hear him be asked questions by the assistant editor of the Final Call newspaper, Brother Ashad Muhammad. That's this Wednesday, 8 p.m. So Minister Farrakhan is very much so accessible. And I bring that up about him being in Cuba and dealing with the aboriginal people of the planet, that, you know, we're united. And I was in Washington, D.C., and I'm not sure if I mentioned this last week, but I went to the King Monument, and Martin Luther King Monument, and there was this Latino brother that came to me, an older gentleman. I have not met him, don't know him, never seen him in my life, but he came up to me and gave me a handshake like I've been knowing him for years, and he hugged me. And then he let me go, and he touched his heart, and then he touched my heart, and then opened his arms again and hugged me again. And what he was trying to say, I love you, and you should love, you know, our hearts are one heart. We beat the same blood, and I love you, brother. And no words were spoken, but I understood clearly what he was saying. So in the wake of that experience, it was a wonderful experience being with him. Some people that I worked with went to Dudley, North Carolina, and they went down to the tobacco fields in North Carolina and met with the immigrant workers that are working on these farm conditions. So when we talk about tonight, the new Jim Crow, and we look at what we went through in the wake of slavery and suffering, there are still brothers and sisters that are our brothers and sisters working on tobacco fields that are literally at night laying on the ground. They may have a shed over them, but they're literally laying on the ground in subhuman conditions. So when you look at the mass incarceration of black and brown in the prison system, and they're making less than no money per day, you know, in the funds and amount of money that they generate for major corporations, but they're making no money, just as the same way as tobacco companies and the Newports that black people smoke. There are Latino brothers that's working to pick that tobacco for those cigarettes that you smoke, but they're living as slaves, literal slaves, in 2012. So as you said about this presidential election and this RNC or the Republican candidate, Mitt Romney's talking about, you know, this 47%, you know, y'all need to get up and do for self. And in the discussion that we just had, the fact that he can even say 250,000 is considered middle class, and I'm like, wow, how far removed are you from the middle class? And if 250,000 is middle class, then I guess 100,000 is poor. So that means that everybody under 100,000 is not even on the statistical radar to be even looked at or considered. So as we always say, and that's why we started with Minister Farrakhan, who will speak and represent the poor? And that man is the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, because we're looking for those in this seat of the United States to look after the concerns of those that are downtrodden and the poor and oppressed, and we're looking to the wrong place for that salvation.
And you know, someone did an assessment of the frequency with which poor people were mentioned at both conventions,
right,
the Republican and Democrat, and it was something in the neighborhood of 0.016%
literally
of the discussions held and the speeches made. There's only talk of I'm so glad you're addressing this, Brother Terrence. You know, $250,000 a year in income is considered middle class by a man who is seeking the presidency of the United States of America, a man who says to his colleagues at a dinner that costs $50,000 a person,
right,
to attend, when the average black family doesn't earn $50,000 total for a year, and you had to buy a $50,000 ticket to come into this dinner, and he's telling the people, because he had been asked earlier, why should he be given these big checks that he was asking for? And one dinner guest wanted to know, they made the statement on the tape, they said, for the last 3 years, you all, you know, meaning the Republican Party politicians and campaign advisors, you all have been telling us, don't worry about it, we'll take care of it. Now, how insidious is that? See, here's a multimillionaire or billionaire Caucasian saying to one of their tools, you all promised us the past 3 years you would take care of it. Take care of what? The nightmare that a black man is in the Oval Office. And he said, you know, how can you, he's saying this to Romney, how can you guarantee us with less than 2 months left to the election that you're going to sell them, now listen to this, sell them on the idea that they need to take care of themselves. See, there is a plan to return us to the natural, with what is viewed by the top tier 1% as the natural way of things, and that is you either have everything or you have nothing. This whole idea of a middle class is an affront to these people. And worse than the existence of a middle class is the idea that black people are making their way into that so-called middle class. And so This man is talking about an ideology where the masses are being convinced that, look, if you don't have anything, it's your fault. It's not racism. It's not sexism. It's not materialism. It's not greed. All of those things that Minister Farrakhan teaches in the study guide. The cause of your condition is you.
Right.
And if you would get up and take care of yourself and not come to us, you would be all right. It is not up to us to, if I make $1 billion a year, I should pay nothing in taxes because I got this money as a result of the fact that I'm entitled to it. And so Mitt Romney told them, look, 47% of the United States population backs Barack Obama. There's nothing we can do about that because these people are people that perceive themselves as victims. They're basically looking for a handout, and they want everything free. They feel entitled to food and housing, and so they back Barack Obama, you know, because he's going to give them that, in essence. So I'm not concerned with those people, you know, I'm going after those 5 to 6% that remain undecided, and since that has been exposed, it is giving the public, for the first time, a real picture, not only of what this man is about, but what the children of our former slave masters are planning for us. And if you don't even have any concern over my vote, then how will you view me when you begin to govern?
And it's even deeper when I think about there's two dynamics that come to my mind is that, number one, there's a large group of people that believe, literally believe, as he believes. That's number one.
Yes.
Number two, that the other people that do not believe as he believed, that's in the Republican Party, still accept him out of so much hatred for Obama. So you got
amazing.
A whole group of people that actually believe this philosophy and this thought that there are people that may be under 250,000 or they're not even in the stratosphere. They're not even in the playing field. They're not even thought about as existing as a people because they don't deal with them in any social context whatsoever. So they're not even looking at them for their concerns because they're not part of their inner circle to worry about. And then if the Republican Party just don't believe anything he's saying, and they may say, oh, you're just messing up. Yeah, you may believe that, but we're just trying to get Obama out the office. They still would not correct him, and they still out of their hatred will support him out of them disliking Obama and want him out of office, as we saw in 2008, we're seeing in 2012 that amount of gun sales are going back up. So this country, as some people have said, if President Barack Obama is reelected, there will be a civil unrest in this country.
Yes.
Because we're continuously seeing, and that's why discussion of separation is continuously coming up, is that
right.
These people are done with us, do not want to be with us, and they have so much hatred that they do not care if you're the president of the United States. I will still spit in your face, talk about you on air, and no one will do nothing to me or say anything to me about my open and blunt disrespect of you in your office as president.
That is exactly right. And, of course, Dr. Rizzi, I did not greet you and welcome you into the conversation. Assalamu alaikum, Dr. Ridgely.
Walaikum assalam, sister and brother. You know, some people say I talk too much, so I decided I'd just listen. But I would like to say, you know, one thing, going back to the Honorable Elijah Muhammad told us that history rewards our research.
Mm.
Now, if you go back to the secret relationship between blacks and Jews, we find that the system of capitalism needs a scapegoat. And we as black people in America have been the scapegoat by which they can blame all of their problems on us. So now the rich robbed the treasury at the end of 2008, put a black man in charge of it, and now blame him for the situation in the country. That's called scapegoating, and they know they can appeal towards the hatred and ignorant white people. And even though what he's trying to do, as the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan said, let this brother help you because he wants to help you, don't hamstring him.
Right.
And in fact, that's what they have done for the last 3.5, now going on 4 years, have hamstrung him and still want to blame him for a situation that they created because it satisfies their inherent hatred of anything other than white skin.
That's an excellent point. And, you know, in response to being busted, you know, Romney, because he's the quintessential white male, he has nothing in him that enables him to ever be remorseful or apologetic for anything he does at any time, because it's that God complex. And so in the face of being busted, they go and pull out a 1998 clip of President Obama when he was a state senator in Illinois talking about pooling resources and redistributing funds, government funds, in his words, to help give everyone a shot. Number one, he wasn't talking about redistribution of wealth in the context of taking money from rich people, going up in their houses and robbing them and giving it to the poor. That's the image these people like to project, as if their wealth was legitimately gained in the first place. But Obama was talking about tax money that the government already had and re-evaluating programs and using the funds in a fair and just way. But all of that aside, it is the single largest move of wealth redistribution in the United States, in U.S. history, was the bailout of the Wall Street banks.
That's right.
Where, as you just talked about, Dr. Rich, you know, we were robbed. They took American taxpayers' money.
Yes.
And to save.
That's right.
For-profit pirates who were in the business of gambling. That's what Wall Street is. It's a big, giant lottery. It's a big, giant gaming table. It's just that only white boys are allowed to play.
Yes.
And it has the facade of being something legitimate and
That's
moral
right.
and elegant and intelligent, but it's nothing but a giant gambling table where people
right.
become billionaires sitting on laptops and iPads. They went broke. They made a bet on robbing us with these predatory home loans, with these derivatives, and it fell through. And so they lost. Now, what happens when a business loses money? They close.
Right.
Why didn't they just close?
Because
as the statement was, they're too big to fail. They're holding all of the wealth of America.
Right.
So the American taxpayer, the postal worker, the guy
right.
that picks up the garbage, these are the people whose money was taken.
Yes.
$700 billion.
Well, that's just the tip of the iceberg, because they say that over that time period, the American people lost 40% of their wealth.
That's what I was going to – thank you for saying it. Right. Obama, under Obama, the wealthy have grown wealthier.
That's right.
Right.
And yet they're still attacking him. But we've got Brother Sean is on with a comment about the bailout, and then Sister Lisa. And shortly, we will have our special guest, Michelle Alexander, author of The New Jim Crow. It's a great show tonight. Assalamu alaikum, Brother Sean.
Well, ladies and salam, Sister Ava. This is Brother Sean from Montgomery 5, New Brunswick, New Jersey. I just wanted to compliment you, sister, on your lectures. I always follow your lectures. But I'm one of the brothers that actually work on the military base, and I'm a contractor for the military. And today, what they're doing is they're when the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan said that they're getting ready for civil unrest, they have units already stationed in the United States ready to when the National Defense Authorization Act, when that passed, they have units that I work with that are already stationed in the battlefield of the United States. So they're already prepared for civil unrest, whatever they're going to do with the presidential election. And Michelle Alexander, I have her book. Actually, I downloaded it off of iTunes. It's a great book. It's a great read. And I just wanted to thank you, sister. I just wanted to make that comment about how – oh, my son. Yes, it's ice cream, son. I'm sorry. Mom, I just wanted to make the point that they're ready. Everything is in place for civil unrest. And today we had an emergency lockdown on the base. And the drill was if a lone gunman came on the base, we have to lock the doors, don't let nobody in or don't let anybody out. So they're already doing these rehearsals. They're doing all these drills. So all of the stuff that the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, I don't want to let the nation know that we are right and exact, and the minister is right and exact with everything that he's saying and everything he's teaching. But that was my comment.
Well, thank you. Well, alaikum salam, and thank you for that information. Very, very insightful.
Can I add something to that?
You very quickly, because we have Michelle Alexander on the line, and she's only going to be with us 30 minutes, but go right ahead.
No, yes, very sir. Quickly. They moved the 8th Tank Division from Fort Knox down here to Fort Benning to be a direct access to Atlanta in case things go down. So they're not guarding the gold no more. They got them all down here ready for this action
Absolutely.
That Brother's talking about.
Yes, absolutely. And one more thing I wanted to say was they just had a national drill where all of these units that are stationed in the United States, they had all of the units that are all over the United States do a national drill where they all work together and coincide together. They have all the helicopters. They got all the surveillance equipment. They have everything in place. Everything is in place that the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan talked about. But I know Michelle Alexander. I can't wait to hear from her because the sister is
absolutely
on point with it. Yes. I'll be on the line for Dava.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, sister. And may Allah continue to bless you all.
Thank you. All right. Winner of the 2011 NAACP Award for Best Nonfiction. The Forbes magazine calls this book devastating. San Francisco Chronicle calls it the Bible of a social movement. A stunning account of the rebirth of a caste-like system in the United States, one that has resulted in millions of African Americans locked behind bars and then relegated to a permanent second-class status, denied the very rights supposedly won in the civil rights movement. And you know, on this show, on Elevated Places, we love the truth. And other than Minister Louis Farrakhan, you're going to be hard-pressed today in the so-called post-racial America to find a more brave spokesperson for the suffering of our people than the person you are about to hear on this show. And this woman is nothing less than extraordinary. I am in the middle of reading her book, and you can trust and believe that her name will be written in history right along with Sojourner Truth, Harriet Tubman, Ida B. Wells, Fannie Lou Hamer, as one who is confronting America today, 2012, with an in-your-face truth. And it is my privilege to welcome and introduce the author of The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, Sister Michelle Alexander. Michelle, thank you so much for coming on, and welcome to Elevated Places.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me on the show and for just inviting me to participate in this dialogue. It was a very generous introduction, and I'm so thrilled that there are places like this, like your show, where people are really committed to seeking and telling the truth. Because like you noted, it's hard to come by today in the mainstream media and the mainstream news. And I'm just so grateful that really, thanks to a grassroots effort, that my book has really begun to catch on and the message is being heard. So thank you. Thank you for having this conversation, inviting me to participate in it.
Well, I'll tell you, first of all, let me just say congratulations on your work. And I am a native of Columbus, Ohio, and so I was very delighted to hear that you are at OSU. But I want you to know, first of all, that we have a panel here, along with myself, Terrence Muhammad, who you met and invited you on, and Dr. Ridgely Muhammad. He's an agricultural economist and contributor to Elevated Places. And I'll tell you, Michelle, all of the adjectives about your book are true. And I really, one of the things that blew my mind that I've never seen anyone address is the distinction you make between class and caste. But even before you get to that, and I know you're short on time, but we want to pull as much as we can, you spoke about an awakening that you experienced. And you are an attorney. You have a very profound background. But if you could just briefly talk about, you talked about an awakening to what you called a racial reality. And if you could describe that briefly before we get into the book itself.
Well, you know, for a long while, I thought I knew how our criminal justice system worked. You know, I graduated from one of the best law schools in the country. I was committed to racial justice. I had worked in a public defender office. I was working as a civil rights lawyer and advocate representing victims of racial profiling and police brutality. And, you know, I thought I got it. But I had a series of experiences that really did lead me to what I now call my awakening. I began to awaken to a racial reality that is just so obvious to me now that it astounds me in retrospect that I had been blind to it for so long. And I could go on and on. I could spend an hour talking just about those experiences. But, you know, to make a long story short, one in particular really woke me up, and it involved a young black man who I was considering representing, and he told me about his experiences with the police. And when I found out that he had a drug felony, I told him that we couldn't represent him as a named plaintiff in a racial profiling case because of his past criminal conviction. I knew that if we had him listed as our lead plaintiff, law enforcement, the media would be all over us saying, well, of course the police should be keeping an eye on him. You know, he's a felon. He's a drug felon. And I knew we wouldn't be able to put him on the stand as a lead plaintiff without him being cross-examined for an hour about his prior criminal history, you know, taking the attention away from what the police were doing and putting it on him and his prior, you know, criminal history and, you know, undermining his credibility in front of the jury. And so I just said, I'm sorry, we can't represent you because of your felony. And he became enraged, telling me that he had been framed by the police, drugs had been planted on him, you know, he'd been set up, told me this big, long story. And I didn't believe him. I didn't believe the story he was telling. And I really kind of just shut him down, saying, I'm sorry, I can't represent you if you have a felony record. He kept telling me that he only pled guilty because they were threatening him with decades behind bars, and he just took the plea because they said, if you just plea out and just take that plea, you can walk and get just felony probation. And he said, you know, what's to become of me now? You know, I can't get a job anywhere. I can't even, you know, get hired anywhere because of my felony record. He said, I'm barred from public housing. I can't even get food stamps. I can't even feed myself as a man. You know, what's to become of me? And he said, you know, good luck finding one young black man in my neighborhood. They haven't got to yet. You know, they've gotten to us all already. And he stormed out, furious.
Wow.
I wound up finding out many months later, that he had been telling the truth. He had been framed by the police. The Oakland Riders police scandal broke. It turned out that a gang of police officers, otherwise known as a drug task force, had been planting drugs on suspects and beating folks up. And one of the main officers charged with planting drugs on folks and beating folks up was the officer he had identified to me as having planted drugs on him and set him up. And it was really only then that, you know, the light bulb started to go on for me, and I realized I was no better than the police. You know,
yes,
the minute he told me he was a felon, I stopped listening. I couldn't hear what he had to say. And I started asking myself, why is it that we haven't been able to find one young black man in his neighborhood they haven't gotten to yet? What is really going on? And that was really what began an enormous amount of research and just listening more carefully to the stories of those cycling in and out of the prison system. And what I finally learned in that process just blew my mind. I came to see that our criminal justice system really functions more like a caste system than a system of crime prevention and control.
And you, that's a perfect segue into my first question. And I know the other panel members have questions too, and we also have callers that want to talk to you. Caste and class. I'm a lawyer myself. I was an assistant DA in New York, and never, even though, as you said, you think you see it, you think you comprehend racism, you think you comprehend the consequences of it. But when you said, we're not just talking about an underclass, we're talking about a caste, and I think it would be enlightening to tell the listeners, what is the difference between class and caste?
Well, the way I use the term caste is to refer to systems, legal systems of racial, social control that operate to lock people into a permanent second-class status by law. You know, slavery was a caste system that locked, you know, black people into an inferior status by law as slaves. Jim Crow, which authorized legal discrimination against African Americans in the South and many other places, throughout our nation as well. That legal system of racial segregation operated like a caste system, legally relegating people defined by race to a permanent second-class status. And today, we have a system of mass incarceration that functions very much like a caste system. People are born into the system. You are born into ghettoized neighborhoods where your parents probably have already been branded criminals or felons, have some kind of criminal record that make legal discrimination in employment, housing, access to education, public benefits, and voting perfectly legal. If you have a felony record, you're denied the right to serve on juries. So you're born into a community where your parents already have been stripped of the basic civil and human rights supposedly won in the civil rights movement. And then as you get just a little bit older, you find that you're the target of the police. You will be stopped, frisked, searched without cause. No reasonable suspicion or probable cause. The U.S. Supreme Court has now given the police authorization to stop, frisk, search just about anyone, anywhere, without a shred of evidence of criminal activity as long as they get consent, which is really just compliance, and it's your word against the police officers anyway if you refuse consent. You're stopped, frisked, targeted. If you have a car and you're old enough to drive, your car is stopped, pulled over. And sooner or later, whether you've done wrong or not, you're going to find yourself swept into the system, branded a criminal and a felon, and then you yourself will be stripped of those very crucial rights, those rights of basic citizenship, the right to be free of legal discrimination in all of these areas. And you enter that parallel social universe into a permanent second-class status. And this isn't some phenomenon that affects some small segment of the African-American community. You know, in many large urban areas today, more than half of working-age African-American men have criminal records and are thus subject to legalized discrimination for the rest of their lives. In cities like Chicago or Baltimore, Philly, you know, the statistics are far worse. Nearly 80% of working-age African-American men in Chicago have criminal records and are thus subject to legalized discrimination for the rest of their lives, having to check that box on employment applications asking, have you ever been convicted of a felony? For the rest of their lives, knowing that application likely headed straight to the trash. So this is a system that has emerged, you know, not gradually over a short period of time. It's a system that was created in a few short decades, you know, a system of mass incarceration that has been created not in response to crime or crime rates, which is the big myth, that the prison explosion can be explained by crime or crime rates, which is just absolutely not true. And I spend quite a bit of time in the book trying to demonstrate why
it's
just clearly not the case. But it's a system that is really best explained as a backlash against the civil rights movement, against the Black Power movement, against the gains of African Americans in that period. And it was a deliberate effort by politicians to exploit racial divisions for political gain with this get tough on crime and get tough on welfare rhetoric. And now the system is born, and millions of people are under its control directly or indirectly.
You know, and it fits right in then with this current presidential election with various states, particularly the Republican-controlled states, which is most of them, passing legislation now demanding state-issued photo ID order for us to exercise a very fundamental right. So that's taking us back. The difficulty of obtaining that type of identification, and as you're saying, once we get that label of felon on us, it's just an endless list of negatives that stay with us permanently.
Yes, and you know, it's interesting because felon disenfranchisement is, you know, the reason Al Gore was not president of the United States in 2000. You know, if you recall, 2000 was the year when the U.S. Supreme Court basically handed, you know, Bush the election. You know, the election was too close to call in Florida. Well, if, you know, felons had had the right to vote in Florida, Al Gore would have won the presidential election by a sizable margin. Florida would have gone for Al Gore. And so you would think that the Democrats this time around and President Obama this time around, you know, really would have made a top priority trying to repeal these felon disenfranchisement laws, many of which were operating in key swing states. But, no, you don't hear anything about that. You hear about voter ID, which itself is a huge problem, but nobody wants to talk about, you know, the millions of people who won't be able to vote because of felony records.
Exactly. And before, we're going to go to the phones while we have you, but was that Brother Terrence or
yes,
Dr.
Ma'am.
Lucy? Okay, yes,
no,
sir.
I just wanted to jump in and before we get off the call, I really have to say this, and I really thank her. I mean, beyond words, thank her for coming on the show. And I say that because when we were together in Cincinnati and we was walking as she was leaving, I mean, she was surrounded. I mean, like, you know, she speaks to crowds, and after she spoke, everybody huddled her. And I, you know, being in the nation, understanding security, understanding the value of our people, I wanted to make sure she was okay. And so I asked her to come on the show, and she could have said, yeah, I'll be on there, and never got back in touch, but she gave us the right contact. She said she was going to come back, and we don't know, and I got a glimpse of her schedule. She booked. I mean, like, almost a year out.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but almost a year out. So she said, well, yeah, I will come on the show. And she gave a word, and she's here. And I say that because not just her work and her book, but her integrity. And she's a humble. sister, a very, very humble sister, mm-hmm. but she has laid this book out. Even when we first started talking on this conversation about the military, if you go to page 75 and she talks about this war, this crime war or waging war and what, you know, the SWAT team and what they're doing now, or you talked about how people are, what she talks about on page 169, gangster love, why we're embracing this gang life and the psychology of that, then you start understanding the systematic breakdown that she talks about. And it's, I'm just thankful that she's on here and the work that she's done and that she's offering herself to be on such a show like this with Sister Ava and ourselves, and to be able to take calls because she's humble enough. And we need to appreciate people that are people of integrity, scholarship, and fearlessness, because what she has put out is not only just dealing with a prison industrial complex, but she's dealing with politics and dealing with big business, because we know prison is big billion dollar industry. And so when you talk against that, then you really are saying something, and you're saying things right. and speaking to powers that's very dangerous.
That's right. Well, we've got
thank you so much. And I just want to say real quick how much I appreciated you at that conference. And it's just so wonderful to have, you know, strong, smart, committed brothers like yourself who, you know, are serious about these issues and who are also looking out for
yes,
people like
you
the way that you did. So I appreciate that. I really do.
Awesome. This is awesome. We've got Peggy on the line, and she, I think she has a comment on the book, how the book has affected her. Welcome to Elevated Places, Sister Peggy.
Thank you so much.
Alaikum.
Walaikum salam. Sister Dr. Ava, Brother Terrence, Brother Dr. Ridgely, assalamu alaikum. Miss Alexander, assalamu alaikum, and good evening. Reading your book, ma'am, was an experience. You know, Brother Robert, student minister of Mosque Number 45, introduced me to the book as one of the resources of one of his lectures. But after I purchased the book, I couldn't even read it for months. I just put it up on the shelf because I had such a visceral reaction when I handled the book. You know, I got butterflies and my palms got sweaty. But once I read it, I was able to appreciate for the intellectual ingenuity it really is. Once I got through the emotionalism of the antidotes, I found it to be extremely extraordinary. And I have a question for you, ma'am. Miss Alexander and Sister Dr. Ava, on the back flap it says that you were a law clerk for Supreme Court Justice Harry Blackmun. Do you believe that as a law clerk that you can have any influence on the decisions handed down by a justice of any court, especially in cases having to do with us?
Yes. I think you definitely can have an influence. It depends a lot on the judge that you're working for, the justice. The clerks are influential in some subtle ways. You know, clerks can influence, you know, how much attention, you know, a judge pays to a case. You can help to frame the issues in a way that's either favorable or not so favorable, you know, to the defendant or, you know, the parties involved. And, you know, as a law clerk, I wrote the opinions, you know, so what the opinions actually say, those were, you know, my words. And the judge would, you know, edit them or provide feedback and that sort of thing. But, you know, clerks do have, you know, a lot of influence. They're not the ultimate deciders, of course, but they do have the ability to influence. And, you know, I should add that, you know, at the U.S. Supreme Court level, there have historically been very, very few black clerks. I mean, very, very few. And so, you know, I think that has been unfortunate, and I don't see it changing anytime soon. But, you know, it's not just who the judges are, but it's also who they surround themselves with that matter.
Absolutely. Thank you, Sister Peggy, for the question. We have Adrian on the line who's been holding for a bit, and Adrian wants to know, why is massive incarceration so important to her as a black woman? Sister Adrienne, welcome to Elevated Places.
Assalamu alaikum, sister. I speak to you and your guests.
Oh, yes, ma'am. I mean, yes,
ma'am. Also,
sorry.
Yeah, this is Brother Adrienne.
I'm sorry.
Also, I'd like to know from Ms. Alexander, how much does ownership of mass, of how much of the lack of ownership of blacks owning mass media play a part in mass incarceration?
That's a great question. You know, as for kind of why this is such an important issue to me personally, part of it has to do with my own experience, as I mentioned, you know, representing people who are trapped in this system and working on their behalf of what I learned in that process and how my own eyes were opened. And I firmly believe that mass incarceration is the most pressing racial justice issue of our time. And that, you know, there has been too much silence about it. There's been way too much denial. And that, you know, if we don't wake up, you know, this system will not only continue to exist for generations to come, but it will become larger, more deeply entrenched, and do even more damage to our communities. Right now, black women are the fastest growing segment of the prison system. And, you know, as we know, black families are fragile enough as they are.
That's right.
We don't need to be, you know, having black women swept up into the system for this minor stuff as well. So, you know, it is really kind of the cause that I am most passionate about and that I'm really committing my life to. As far as kind of owning mass media and having some control over the mass media, I think, you know, it's an enormous problem. I mean, we don't get anything approaching the truth from Fox News, CNN, even MSNBC, which, you know, frames itself as being the more liberal alternative.
Right.
You know, we don't hear the perspective of those who are trapped within the undercast. Their voices are rarely heard. Their stories are rarely told. Their experiences are rarely conveyed. The kinds of truths that, you know, I have tried to tell in this book and others have been telling, you know, in their communities, you know, rarely make it into the mainstream news. And I think that, you know, the internet and things like this Blog Talk Radio and all of that, it creates opportunities for us to ensure that the truth gets told without, you know, relying on mainstream media to do it. And I hope that we'll become far more strategic in our communication efforts so that, you know, no matter who you are, where you live, you will have easy access to and knowledge about sources of the truth.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things I think, as Sister Peggy pointed out, in her assessment is similar to a lot of the reviews about, I think the rarity in your work is that balance between the intellectual depth of it, but that passion. And you have a way of bringing to the forefront very startling facts. I know that when I first heard about the book about a year ago, one of my colleagues in the ministry, who's our minister in Philadelphia, told me about it. And what had struck him that he hit me with is this fact that there are more black people incarcerated or under correctional control.
Yes, more African American adults.
Yes, that yes. Is just earth shaking.
Than when we were enslaved.
Yeah, than when we were in slavery.
Yes, yeah, there are more African American adults under correctional control in prison or jail, on probation or parole, than were enslaved in 1850. And 1850 was a decade before the Civil War began. You know, that was peak of slavery. And so it's really the scale of the system. And I think that for people who are not directly impacted by it, it's easy to just be completely unaware, ignorant of the scale of this thing. I mean, it's out of sight, out of mind. You know, back during the Jim Crow days, you know, there were whites only signs. You know, you couldn't deny the reality of the caste system. It was right in your face. But
right.
UK prisons are hundreds of miles away. You know, often, you know, most new prison construction has occurred in predominantly white rural communities, you know, communities that now come to believe that prisons are a source of their economic growth and jobs and,
jobs,
you know,
exactly.
all the rest. But it's out of sight, out of mind. And if you're not living in a community directly impacted, it's easy to believe that, you know, this is a figment of our collective imagination.
Yes. All by design. We've got Brother Stowell, and he has a comment and a question about the book. Let me
quick
get his
comment.
Mic open. Yes,
good
sir. Good. Assalamu alaikum, how are you?
Wa alaikum salam, I'm fine. I'm a move fast. I appreciate your book, and it reminds me of three books. First, Derek Bell from Harvard,
mm-hmm.
Faces
mm-hmm.
at the Bottom of the Well.
Yes.
Andrew Hacker, Two Nations, Separate and Unequal. And the third mm-hmm. being Torchlight for America by the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, in your book on the acknowledgments on page 10, you said, my husband, Carter Stewart, has been my rock. He has read and reread drafts. As a federal prosecutor, he does not share my views about the criminal justice system. Would you share with us where he differs with you in your book? Thank you so
yes.
much, and I do appreciate you. Assalamu alaikum.
Thank you for the call.
Yes.
Yes, thank you. Yes, my husband is a federal prosecutor, and you know, that has been source of no small tension in our relationship. But, you know, the truth is that, you know, he doesn't disagree with most of, you know, what's in it. I've been trying to pin him down on what, if anything, he actually does disagree with, because, you know, I'm not aware of any facts that I've cited that he disagrees with, you know, or even the overall, you know, thesis of the book. Our major disagreement is about whether you can make much of a difference from within the system.
Okay.
He believes that it's very important for there to be good people working as prosecutors, working as police officers, that we need good people in those roles, people who will not abuse their authority, who will try to seek justice and not simply, you know, try to lock people up, lock them out for the rest of their lives. And, you know, I agree that we need good people, you know, to be part of a system of justice, but my own view is that this system is now so thoroughly corrupt,
mm-hmm.
and it functions so much more like a caste system than a system of crime prevention and control, that it actually does more harm than good to have good people playing the role of prosecutors. It gives the system a veneer of credibility it doesn't deserve. I often say to him, only, you know, half joking, that, you know, would it be better to have kinder, gentler slave drivers during slavery, or was an order of abolition of slavery? And I think we don't necessarily need right now at this critical moment simply kinder, gentler prosecutors and police officers who are going to, you know, show a little more compassion on the margins. I really hope that people who have the skills, talents, abilities of my husband would be really committed to trying to dismantle the system as a whole and create anew a system of justice that is truly just. And, you know, if we were to actually dismantle the system of mass incarceration and just return to the rates of incarceration we had in the 1970s or early 80s, before the war on drugs, you know, gained steam, before the Get Tough movement really kicked off, you know, if we were to return to the rates of incarceration we had in the 1970s, a time, by the way, when many, you know, racial justice advocates thought that rates of incarceration were just egregiously high for black folks, if we were just to return to those days, we would have to release 4 out of 5 people who are in prison today. You know, a million people employed by the criminal justice system would lose their jobs. So in my view, this isn't just about cutting a few guys a break, you know, who come across your desk. It's about getting serious, about building a movement that will actually end this system as we know it.
Wow, that's powerful, powerful insight. And it's also very intriguing to understand the dynamics of a marriage. And, you know, I feel that what you have is a calling. And so it's admirable on his part, you know, to even deal with a black woman of that caliber.
Well,
you know,
can I add something here?
Sure.
You know, this dynamic that Ms. Alexander and her husband are going through, you know, in this book called Disciplined Minds, I keep, you know, coming up with.
Oh, yes.
About how the system, how it forms people's minds, and how it was, Michelle Alexander said it took an awakening. She was actually blind at one time to what was going on, and it took an incident to break that. So it's almost like some type of veil or some type of magic trick over the minds of our intellectual people who go through the system, so that they can't even see things in certain perspectives, because then they would be quote-unquote unprofessional if they did. So the science of how they control our minds, and then the understanding of how a person can break through that barrier is to me is very interesting.
Yeah, that's a key component, and I'm glad you brought that up, Dr. Ridgely, because, and I know Sister Michelle, you have to go, but one key thing, and of course, listeners, you can go to newjimcrow.com, which is a great website, and also you can order the book there. It's just something, it's a classic, you know, reminds me of growing up and us having certain books in our house, my parents making sure they had everything out of the few available books in those days. This is something that has to be in your library. But you talk about the educational system, you know, of America, you know, concomitant with this. It feeds it. It's the pipeline to this prison system. And as Dr. Ridgely's pointing out, one aspect of that is how the educated, so-called middle-class black people, we get disconnected from our people, and we have this false idea that this is not as extensive as it is. That really this condition is the dominant condition of black people. You know, if we're living a comfortable life, that's an exception. You know, that somehow, because of help from here and there, and our parents being particularly committed, et cetera, we were able to get through that to a very limited extent. But I think that's critical that your discussion on the education system itself is very important for us to understand.
Yeah, you know, one of the most frustrating things for me after Obama was elected was to hear, you know, people saying, black folks saying, you know, I would listen to the radio and I hear people saying, you know, well, now that, you know, President Obama has been elected, you know, the message to our children would be, you know, no more excuses. If Obama can do it, you can do it too. You too can be president of the United States, no matter, you know, where you're from, and all this. And you know, I just listened to that, and I think, gosh, you know, Obama, he was raised by a white mother in Kansas and white grandparents in Hawaii, and he admitted to cocaine use, marijuana use in his youth, quite a bit of it, you know, on predominantly white college campuses in Hawaii. You know, if he had been a kid raised in the hood.
Come on.
He would have been stopped. He would have been frisked. He would have been caught. And far from being president of the United States today, he might not even have the right to vote, depending on what state he lives in. You know, so this idea that, you know, Obama made it so that means you can too, you know, just doesn't, it just, flatly ignores how radically different Obama's life experience has been, you know, as compared to, you know, a kid who's being raised in inner city Baltimore, Chicago, Philly, L.A., you know, it's a world apart. But we want to be in denial about that because it's much more convenient for our nation to imagine we've entered into this era of colorblindness.
Yes, ma'am. Well, if you could be so kind, take one more call, and
okay, sure.
Hoping that in the near future, as Brother Terrence said, we know your schedule is unbelievable, and so we are so grateful for the time, and we're going to keep talking about the book after you're gone. Because it is worthy of intense study. But we have Ralph on the line with a comment. Ralph, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to Elevated Places.
Wa alaikum salam. How are you, beloved?
Wonderful. Thank you.
Crazy. Yes, I tried to get in touch with you a while back, sister, and unfortunately I wasn't able to, but I just wanted to make a comment about this, sister, that myself and I don't know if you're familiar with Brother Robert Muhammad out of New York. This is Marissa Alexander. She's serving a 20-year sentence now because she fired a shot up in the ceiling of a home to try to frighten off her abusive husband.
Oh, yes, yes.
Mm.
Yes.
Mm. Yes.
And I was just, you know, trying to get some help from this sister because she had this little bootlicking Negro attorney for over a year and a half. Mm-hmm. And me and Brother Robert out of New York, we did more for this sister's behalf in 2 weeks than what this fella had done in about a year and a half, and almost $100,000 in funds. I understand that he's been paid. And I was just trying to find out, is there anything, I don't know exactly what type of law that you study or whatnot, but if there was anything that y'all could do on the behalf of this sister, you know, I would be glad to. I'll get y'all in touch with her mother and her sister. And she had the two beautiful little children that, you know, left behind. And if there was anything that y'all could do to help, you know, I was trying to find out if I could get better assistance.
Okay, well, we'll keep your number. I'll take it off the screen. And Michelle, if you could give your comments on that, we'd appreciate it.
Yes. Well, you know, first I apologize if I wasn't able to respond to what any letter or email you may have sent to me. I mean, I have to say it absolutely, you know, breaks me to hear these stories. I have literally several hundred letters from prisoners, families of prisoners who have written to me asking for help and have received, you know, hundreds of emails from people. And it's just impossible for me to get involved in these individual cases. I actually have a family member who's the sister of my brother-in-law, who's actually in prison right now under circumstances almost identical to what you've described, and been working hard trying to figure out a way to get her out. You know, unfortunately, there's very little that I personally can do, but hopefully there are resources available. I don't know if you said, were you in New York? To support
yes.
people, particularly who have claims, you know, of self-defense or related to domestic violence. And I do not remember the name of the organization right now off the top of my head, but if you go online, there is an organization dedicated to providing support to women who have been, you know, convicted of crimes relating to their efforts to defend themselves from abusive partners. And, you know, if you Google legal support for domestic violence victims or something like that, I hope that, you know, you'll be able to get the information that you need. But there are organizations out there that are trying to provide support for people, you know, who find themselves in those situations. But I know how frustrating and just painful it is to try to get help, you know, in this time, because there's so little of it to be found. So I'm sorry that I'm not able to personally be more helpful in your case.
Well, yes, ma'am. And you know, I think what we have to understand is, you know, as I referred earlier to a calling, is that this is a war that we're in. And it's like the different branches of the armed forces. You know, we're fighting different battles, but all for the same cause. And you have taken on the vanguard position, and so that's what you do. And Allah willing, you know, others will be moved. We have plenty of black folks in the legal profession. And in media, and I know that case, I've heard that case in the media, and we've got to do more from that standpoint as well to push it. But to me, and I want to say this before we let you go, that I was, my youngest daughter and I watched a brief documentary the other day on Ida B. Wells Barnett, and I couldn't believe the similarities, you know, with you and her. In that, and this is a test to the power and strength of the black woman, because it was Ida B. Wells Barnett who brought the horrors of lynching to the national stage. You know, the lynching was so common in so-called Reconstruction America that it was just common to see a black body hanging from a tree or the remnants burned to ashes. But that sister, you know, who was born in slavery, but was educated, I think she went to Rust College, but she was born in Mississippi in slavery, but she published the first book on lynching, and it was called The Red Record. And it was actually a pamphlet, it was a big pamphlet, about 100 pages, but it was 14 pages of nothing but statistics. And then her book went into these graphic stories detailing the lynching, and she went around giving speeches based on that book, and that initiated a whole movement. And that is what you're doing for us today. You know, you're bringing this together because we weren't seeing with the precision and comprehension that we are able to see now as a result of your book. And when you have a man like Minister Farrakhan who's got his life on the line, it is such a blessing to us as a people that we have a black woman like you in our midst who could have just sat around and made money, you know, and be cautious and say and do whatever you needed to be acceptable. You didn't have to do this. And so,
thank you very much.
You,
I could never hope to fill her shoes, but I'm so inspired by people like her. And you know, I know we all have our roles to play, and you know,
yes,
we just
ma'am.
Have to be willing to answer the call. So
that's right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. And Sister Michelle, on behalf of all of the listeners in the Elevated Places universe, we are grateful, and God willing, you will join us again, but we will continue to discuss your book. I think it's got to be on every shelf in the country to anybody that is concerned, from among our community in particular, with morality and with respect for human life, freedom, justice, and equality. So may Allah bless you and your husband and your family with much love, and may He protect you, and always know that we got your back.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much.
All
right. Assalamu alaikum.
Good night.
Good night. And so, brothers and sisters, that was our beloved sister, Michelle Alexander. As Brother Terrence said, this is a woman with a serious schedule, and we're glad she took time to come on Elevated Places. We're down to 15 minutes for the whole show, but we want to go to the phones and take some more comments. and questions. We have a call from Columbus, Ohio. And I'm sorry for our callers that we didn't get to while she was on the line, but she only had a 30-minute window. But welcome. This is a call from Columbus. Welcome to Elevated Places.
Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam.
Well, it's a pleasure to finally speak with you, sister. My name is Brother Charles Muhammad here in Columbus, Ohio.
Yes, sir.
And I just have a few statements and then a question.
Okay.
It was a wonderful show. It was my first time being here, so I'm definitely a virgin in that aspect. You spoke eloquently about you know, the prison industrial complex and Sister Michelle and the caste system. You know, myself, I've been caught up in that system. Because of the teachings of the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad, I was able to free myself from that system. And I have not returned since. In fact, the first time I was ever arrested, I was selling the Final Call newspaper.
Ah, yes, sir.
But what I wanted to know, is it possible that some attorneys could come here and look at a system they have here? It's called a future system. And it's nothing more than mischief-making by ways and means of the law, by which if I was charged with something today, September 20th, they have an option to not necessarily incarcerate me or give me any legal ramifications of it, not even probation, but sometime in the future, they can bring that back up and I can be charged. And if I'm not at the same address or I'm not, has not been brought to my attention, I can be charged and, of course, you're arrested and you go through the whole legal ramifications of that. So are you familiar with this, what they call a future system here in Columbus, Ohio?
No, this is the first time I'm hearing of it. My first reaction to that is, it defies, and of course, all of this defies and denies our constitutional rights. But there are part of due process. There are statutes of limitations on the time within which you can prosecute someone for an offense. And
what
so,
I'm
sorry.
What is the limitations of that? Are you familiar with what that is?
It varies with the crime. It varies with it. There's a short time for misdemeanors, longer time for felonies. There are certain crimes, such as homicide, that have no statute of limitations. You know, for example, there was a murder conviction here in Illinois against a man who killed a child in 1957. When he was 17 years old, and they finally got evidence that he was the killer, and they just convicted him this year. But that's on a homicide. But for example, petty theft or something, it depends on state to state. It may be 1 to 3 years, but I've never heard of that. You know, but I'd definitely be interested in looking into it and discuss and, you know, talking about it.
Sure, I'll try
my, on my, you know, in the forums that I speak in.
Okay, because
that is yet again another mechanism that fits in with what Michelle Alexander is talking about, a permanent underclass. That's what I really want us to get out of her appearance on this show among the many powerful things that are in that book. We're not talking about a temporary situation, but being locked in. To the bottom of society, and as she's pointing out, they're pretty much there, and white America has pretty much achieved that. You know, we're looking at the 80 percentile in terms of black people who really have a semi-slave existence, and then of course the prison complex itself, which is a modern day plantation. You know, when you go to prison now, we've talked about that on this show before, you don't just sit in there, you're in there working.
Oh, right. Well, you articulated that best in one of your lectures on a Sunday.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yes. And this is why the system was sold to corporate America, because for-profit companies are getting free labor in the form of black men primarily and a growing number of black women who now have to work for free. You know, but we thank you for your call, Brother Charles, and we'll definitely look into it. Thank you so much. Okay, so we're down to 10 minutes. Did you have a comment, Brother? Oh, I thought I heard one of the brothers.
Yes. This is Brother Terrence. I just want to jump in. And one of the things I do want to say about one of the callers calling about, excuse me, some of the cases, one of the things Dr. Ridgely helped me understand years ago, he let us know as students at North Carolina A&T, he said, we're at war. This is not a game. We're not playing. This is really real. Mm-hmm. So while people are just playing around, joking around, acting like, no, we are literally at war. So when the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan is going to these college campuses, he's letting the young people know we need your help in building a nation because things are serious, to refocus and restructure people's mindsets to get them thinking about things that we need to get involved in. So there's a lot of things that are going on. So blessed is the man or woman who finds his purpose in life, as Minister Farrakhan did a lecture. And I'm saying that to say that you have your champion people that stand up and speak like Michelle Alexander yourself. But what should happen really is we all as a people get prepared and discovering our fields, as Minister Farrakhan laid out, ministries, the non-ministries, and get involved in them so that we can dispatch not just the Michelle Alexanders, but the Michelle Alexander lookalikes, and have people that do those kinds of fields in each city, each area, that we can form a conglomerate or a necessary network to be able to deal with these multiple issues. Because as she said, she gets hundreds and she can't respond to all of them. And so all these cases are going on all across America. And so those that are listening to this radio, we cannot expect some of our leadership to run and answer every call, but we need to start preparing ourselves to answer that call. And as we had the webathon for our MUI, the Muhammad University of Islam, we have to start raising baby warriors and raising our children to get prepared for a reality and a struggle that they're really in. And I'm saying this because people are needing champion. They're needing people to champion this cause, and we have to find a way to answer that call as more and more of these problems are coming up and popping up. And we can't be everywhere, but we have to find out what we can do to help our people
exactly.
in this condition.
Yeah, and because otherwise what we do is we overburden those who have stood up and you know, taken on the cause of truth. And you don't want to do that. You don't want to wear out, just like we don't want to do that to Minister Farrakhan. You know, you don't want to make that person, because they've demonstrated a gift, they've demonstrated courage, but we too have to stand up. But we've got Lisa on the line, and her call has dropped a couple times. We want to make sure we don't miss her before the show ends.
Assalamu alaikum, Sister Ava. Thank you. I guess I had a couple of things to say, but I want to thank you for bringing up Sister Ida B. Wells, because I researched her also in doing work on a book that one of our own ministers survived a lynching, and information on her. And one thing that she did was she brought to the table the issue of what lynching is. It's not just a person hanging from a noose. And they actually had conferences to determine what it was, so that when they had statistics on it, that they were. But Michelle are bringing poverty, racism, and the prison system on the table to be discussed. But there are a lot of solutions that have not even been implemented yet. What I would have liked to know from her is what her stand was like on reparations and the issue of separation, which the nation pushes, because at this point, if the legal system is not going to work for us, then, you know, we're right, we need our own system. And where are we going to go from here? We keep talking about separation, but people who are reaching out to Sister Michelle or the minister, I mean, they do want answers. I mean, to say separate, they don't have the slightest idea of how to begin to do that. And I think it's important that people do have clear, you know, understanding and directives on what they should do so that they can do it. Otherwise, they're going to sit in the same spot and not go anywhere. As for Brother Farrakhan, I want to commend him and the Fruit of Islam for going into the communities. And some things that they can help the brothers do right now is that, you know, Cabrini Green in Chicago has a legal aid clinic where if you can't afford to get your record expunged, you can go there and they take like the first 25 people in the morning if you bring your rap sheet to get your records expunged. We need to encourage our people to get out of debt, get their records expunged. And then in terms of the jobs and the trades you were talking about, the government gives a one-time grant from the Workforce Investment Act of $5,000 to every American citizen. And if you're unemployed, you can just go to your unemployment office, go to counseling and take a test, and then make use of that grant. And then you can go into things like carpentry, masonry, and things like that. And then the third thing is there are universities that are tuition-free that people can take advantage of. One is called the University of the People. And in line with Brother Muammar Gaddafi was trying to do, which was make education free, that's an online program where you can get a bachelor's degree in computer science or business, and all you have to do is pay to register and take your exams. And if you can't afford that, there is financial aid for that.
Yes, ma'am. Well, thank you for those points. We're down to about 4 minutes. I know your call dropped a couple times. What Michelle Alexander said is that she believes in the dismantling of the whole system in terms of a solution. And what we try to do here is bring to the table people that put in front of our consciousness the reality of the impossibility of ever assimilating into white society. We've been with white folks nearly half a millennium. It's actually almost genetic, this desire in us to assimilate with them. That's what distinguishes us from other groups of people. Separation is not unclear. Separation is very clear. What needs to be done is very clear. It was made clear in Message to the Black Man by the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. It's a very simple solution, but it's not an easy solution. It's not easy because deep inside there is this desire to remain with white people. And as Dr. Risley has addressed many times, there's this fear that we will not have a comfortable life, that somehow without white people the world will collapse. That's very real. And so we have to constantly put in front of our people just how extreme the measures that are being taken against us are. And so when you get a work like she produced that lets us know that incarceration is not something that's happening here and there, it's massive. It's upward of 80% of our people have had some encounter with the law that has resulted in them either being in jail, in a correctional facility, or on probation or on parole, and thereby disenfranchised, unable to get a job. And programs are just simply not the answer. The only solution is a separate state or territory of our own. And it's very easy. It's very simple, but it's just not easy. And that's what we have to get past. We have to get past this innate desire to be with white people. But I really appreciate the information that you gave our people, especially that idea that not idea, but the information that one can have one's record expunged if they take advantage of that offer. And so, Brother Terrence, Dr. Ridgely, as always, you all have been awesome, and we really want to thank you, Brother Terrence, in your travels. That you noticed that after you thanked Sister Michelle, that she also expressed her gratitude to you. And we thank you for representing the fruit of Islam in the nation in terms of making sure you were there for her protection. And it's just yet another testimony to the power of the teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad.
Praise be to
Allah. Yes, sir. And so, again, Minister Farrakhan, that's September the 26th. The town hall meeting, is that correct?
Yes,
ma'am. Because my iPad just shut down on me. I had it in front.
Yes, ma'am. And he's also going to be in Baton Rouge Southern University October the 3rd as well.
Yes, absolutely. And Dr. Ridgely, of course, you are working with Brother Alexander and others to convene our engineers, tradesmen, builders. The caller, Sister Lisa, just brought up the reality of separation will start to be implemented. We're definitely going to make it happen. So thank all of you, the Elevated Places team, Sister LaDonna, Sister Rona, Brother Bobby, and Brother Terrence. And may Allah bless all of us with freedom, justice, equality, light, and love. Assalamu alaikum.
Thank you for listening to Elevated Places with Dr. Ava Muhammad. Be sure to join us every Thursday here on blogtalkradio.com/elevatedplaces. If you are a member of our Blog Talk Radio family and you enjoyed the show today, mark Elevated Places as one of your favorites. And remember, the new era will be feminine in nature.